Sarah is a certified rehabilitation counselor with a master's of science from San Diego State University's Rehabilitation Counseling Program, and has an advanced certificate in psychiatric rehabilitation. Sarah previously worked as the NeuroRecover Coordinator at the Center for Health and Well-Being in San Diego, where she helped coordinate the services for people undergoing NeuroRecover and worked as lead researcher. Sarah has lectured more than 70 times at 10 San Diego universities for interdisciplinary programs on a variety of recovery topics. Sarah believes that with proper support, psychiatric recovery isn't just possible, it's probable. Now, today, Sarah will be talking about electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, and the long-term consequences and rehabilitation for a depression treatment. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today. We're so grateful to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. So we're going to be a little bit different this time. Sarah's got some pre-recorded answers to some of our questions. So it may sound a little bit different, but we're still going to get all the great information out of our conversation. It's going to be really, really interesting. So, okay. So my first question, in the title of your talk, we mentioned electroconvulsive therapy or ECT. So can you talk a little bit about what the history of this method is and why it comes into use, or why it came into use?
Before I begin, by way of further introduction, former professor of psychiatric rehabilitation, who's researched ECT consequences for more than a decade. I also live with the neurological sequelae of electrical injury from ECT, a consequence of pulsing merely an ampere current through my trigeminal nerve, a gateway to the brainstem's reticular formation and vagus nerve. For that reason, I now live with a progressive form of acquired sensory-based motor dysfunction. I have difficulty coordinating my muscles to speak, swallow, and breathe. I must use a speech-generating device to communicate more easily. I appreciate your interest in understanding why electroshock is used to treat depression in modern medicine, when there's so much research on how electric current works on the body. I share all this with you because it's what I wish my family and I had been told when we were so desperate for symptom relief, we were willing to try anything. Long-term consequences are worse than any perceived short-term benefit.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us. It gives us some context, and you know, it always really does help when people are speaking out of their own experience and sharing that with our audience and with us. And so thank you so much for that. Maybe we can talk a little bit about electroconvulsive therapy and its history. I know that it has a very long history. Maybe think of it as like electroshock, or maybe that's a term that's more familiar. I think that's what you're talking about, right?
Using electroshock as a treatment for mental illness began 85 years ago. As a bit of background, back in the 1930s, people had been using devices called medical batteries since the 1870s. It was a time when people believed electricity could be used to treat anything from constipation to headaches.
Oh, wow.
Fast forward from the 1870s to 1938, when a Mussolini-era psychiatrist, Professor Ugo Cerlemi, got it in his head to shock a homeless man known for speaking gibberish. Professor Cerlemi shocked the homeless man, causing a muscle spasm. Then David Impostato, psychiatrist, described what happened next. Quote, after the electric spasm, the patient burst into song. The professor suggested that another treatment with a higher voltage be given. The patient suddenly sat up and pontifically proclaimed, no longer in jargon, but in clear Italian, not again. It will kill me. This made the professor think and swallow, but his courage was not lost, and the first electroconvulsion in man ensued. End quote. An article in Psychology Today explains, quote, in 1939, the Italian psychiatrist Renato Almanzi immigrated to the United States to escape rising political tensions and brought with him one of Cerlemi and Bini's early ECT machines. After being introduced to the Italian-American Impostato, whose work had caught the eye of one of Almanzi's former professors in Rome, the two began early experiments with the Cerlemi-Bini device in the hope of introducing the procedure to American psychiatry. New York's Columbus Hospital, later named Italian Hospital and Cabrini Medical Center, where he had served in the psychiatry department for a half dozen years, which agreed to sponsor an ECT clinical trial. Impostato and Almanzi began their work there on February 6, 1940, the earliest hospital-based ECT treatment on record in North America. End quote.
Wow, I mean, that's incredible, this story and how this has come come down to psychiatry and psychology. Forgive me for the pun, but it seems a little shocking. Yeah, I know, it's a good one, right? What kind of safety tests or safety studies have been done on these devices in order to keep people safe through this?
At the time, medical doctors believed that people who had epilepsy could not have schizophrenia, a theory long since disproven. Early psychiatrists had no effective treatment options for symptoms identified as mental illness, so they quickly began using electroshock on anyone that didn't respond to other forms of treatment. Let me be clear, symptoms are only treatment resistant when they're getting the wrong treatment.
Right. Yeah.
It sounds like you want to ask, is electroconvulsive therapy safe? To answer that question, let's discuss last year's submission for a pending court case in Florida.
Okay.
Dr. Janet Arrowsmith, a former Food and Drug Administration employee who now works as a forensic expert witness, stated in her report that only safety testing completed on modern-day ECT devices was a single, unpublished study where the device manufacturer gave electroshock once to a Dalmatian dog, then gave electroshock once to a second Dalmatian dog, and compared the two. In other words, the foundation of modern electroshock treatment is unknowingly built upon how two dogs responded to a single treatment. I don't know about you, but I feel the complexities of human life is more intense than that of barking or tail wagging. Given that information, I leave it to you to decide whether ECT is safe.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say probably not. Right? So, I mean, I guess I'm wondering, like, how is this being used at all, really? I mean, how would a doctor decide what's safe or what dose to use? Or, I mean, can we talk a little bit more about what is happening when it's being used?
I cannot explain the rationale, but you asked how a doctor knows what dose to give. The simple answer is they don't. They have no subspecialty training in biophysics or how powerful current affects human cells, nerves, muscles, or brains. Without this training, they have the responsibility to choose between one of five dosing methods and must factor in more than 12 administration variables. That's why no two doctors give electroconvulsion therapy the same way. No two patients have the same experience. It's impossible to compare outcomes. It's also impossible to find a medical doctor with subspecialty training in electrical injury to provide the FDA-recommended long-term follow-up. Given that information, I leave it to you to decide whether a doctor is qualified to determine a safe dose of electrical current to the human body. Then,
well, okay, I guess my next question is about what kind of effect does it have to have electroconvulsive therapy on the physiology of a person? Like, what is the effect on the body of sending current like that through it?
That's an important question, because last year, a study stated that modern ECT devices use nearly an ampere current without any clinical or scientific rationale. Though, do we understand the consequences of electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, in terms of physiology? We don't. While receiving ECT, I began having problems with balance, coordination, and spoke with a lisp when tired. In 2017, these symptoms quickly grew worse. A trauma nurse learned of my ECT history and advised me to research delayed, diffuse electrical injury, first identified in 1906. In 2007, the United States Congressional Hearing on Gulf War Syndrome recommended creating an ECT patient registry specifically to enable understanding why our nation's veterans have doubled the rate of ALS, because roughly one-third of people with ALS have a history of electrical injury. The registry was not created. So in 2022, after examining 20 years of Medicare data, researchers discovered people with a history of just 10 ECT treatments have more than double the risk of developing ALS before age 65. And that risk triples after age 65.
Wow. Well, okay, so I have heard nothing to suggest that this is a good idea. So I guess my next question is around, I suppose it's being prescribed or are suggested to folks with severe depression because there's a hope that it will help with the condition, with the psychology. So how can this, How can the use of ECT impact the psychology of a person versus their physiology?
Well, we know how important trust is when talking about mental health and wellness. I can only say that daily I interact with people injured by ECT who express a sense of utter betrayal at having been told ECT was safe and effective. Some are even told that it will help by erasing bad memories. But we know that ECT reduces connections within the brain, and we also know that PTSD is associated with reduced connectivity in the brain, which is why I hypothesize that so many ECT recipients struggle with severe symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. Many injured ECT patients describe their experiences as being raped. Considering ECT is not one treatment, it's a repetitive traumatic event with potentially disastrous consequences.
Well, okay. I mean, again, it's I don't know how commonly prescribed this kind of thing is, or I don't know. Maybe you can speak to that quickly before we finish. But what kind of, say your doctor or your therapist or someone was recommending this treatment to you, what kind of things would you need to know in order to have informed consent to agree? What does the FDA require? Be warned about? What kind of things would you be hearing? In the context of perhaps considering starting a treatment like this?
The FDA requires a sign be posted by ECT devices which says, quote, the long-term safety and effectiveness of ECT treatments have not been demonstrated and long-term follow-up may be needed, end quote. One of the device manufacturers published a regulatory update stating that 7 of the variables used to decide ECT dose are directly associated with permanent memory loss and permanent brain damage. In my perspective, I feel that patients should have the right to choose whether they want to risk permanent brain damage. But they must know there are no doctors who are trained in how to provide the long-term follow-up required for people who develop symptoms of delayed electrical injury, nor is there any recognized treatment for these symptoms. They can evolve into a variety of neurodegenerative brain diseases.
Well, I mean, you've made such a compelling argument for why this is a really bad idea and how, you know, the kind of risks that we would be taking on if we were going to consider it. And so I guess I'm left wondering, is there any set of circumstances or any set of symptoms that where you might say this is the only way, or there's not any alternative treatment that might work? Is there ever a case for that?
Doctors who successfully treat patients living with depression don't use ECT. It's best to ask them about alternative treatment methods. In meeting with hundreds of ECT recipients and families whose family members are referred for ECT, I've met people living with profound depression in a variety of situations. For example, a pediatrician in an abusive marriage was diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression. Before that diagnosis was made, she should have been given support to get herself and her children away from an extremely abusive marriage. One elderly woman diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression had stopped eating. Nutrition is essential for brain health. Turns out she'd gradually stopped eating because the stress of caring for her husband who had a terminal illness without sufficient in-home support was overwhelming. After speaking with me, the family chose to get their mother on intravenous nutrition. Her severe symptoms turned around almost immediately. Then the family worked together to better support their mother in caregiving for their father who was dying. I've met 2 men diagnosed with treatment-resistant depression. One lived in a historic home with a history of water damage. The other lived in a home with a bathroom shower that leaked into the wall. Both men were actually living with a diagnosed mold toxicity. I've met countless people referred for ECT who later discovered their treatment-resistant symptoms were caused by medication toxicity or medication withdrawal. I may not be a doctor, but I do know electricity is not magic. Pulsing nearly an ampere current into a human's brainstem will not resolve an abusive home environment.
Yeah.
Electric current to the most delicate organ in the body cannot alleviate work stress or heartbreak. It cannot magically nourish the brain or rid the body of toxins. Blasting nearly an ampere current into a nervous system will fry it, not support the body's nervous system after being injured by medication dependence. There is no research to support any evidence that electroconvulsive therapy can safely treat these issues without unintended immediate or delayed electrical injury consequences.
Well, I mean, it sounds like anyone listening that might be considering a therapy like this should seriously reconsider that and maybe take the time to delve a little bit more deeply into the research that suggests that it's really a bad idea and it's really not going to help. Although I understand that there are a lot of folks out there with very serious depression that may be desperate and may feel like, well, maybe I can just jolt my way back into health. So, you know, you mentioned this a little bit already, but, you know, maybe give some alternative pathways for people or other potential treatment alternatives that they should consider before they take this step, despite the maybe recommendation of their doctor, whoever might be mentioning it to them in the first place. What would you recommend as a potential treatment alternative?
I'm not a medical doctor, so I can only share my experience with locating a functional medical doctor and who had a much larger toolbox of skills from which to make a proper differential diagnosis. Identifying and treating the underlying symptom cause has far less risk and better long-term consequences than the shotgun approach of a medical device with no dosing consensus standards based on rigid pre-market safety testing.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, I've heard nothing here that compels me to want to try this or to suggest that anyone else should, no matter how severe their situation might be. Well, I mean, this has been so fascinating and alarming because we hear the consequences of this sort of thing. And I'm so grateful that you lent us your voice such as it is and that we were able to talk about this. Thank you so much. We've talked about electroconvulsive therapy and just the dangers of it and the unintended consequences of its use. And I hope that our conversation with Sarah has allowed everybody to get a little bit of perspective on why this may not be a very good idea, and that there are other alternative therapies that are going to help you and heal you in a much more effective way. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining us and for our conversation.